Welcome to Our Curious Amalgam, the weekly podcast brought to you by the Antitrust Law Section of the American Bar Association. Our Curious Amalgam explores the fascinating and increasingly overlapping world of competition, consumer protection, data protection, and privacy law. Each week, we bring you leading global experts on the most compelling issues of the day. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Our Curious Amalgam. I'm Jacqueline Phillips, and today's episode is Strong Competition in Gen AI a Hallucination? Discussing economic insights into the evolution of trends in the industry. It took only 2 months for ChatGPT to become the fastest growing consumer application in history. 3 years later, it is a must for business leaders to evaluate how and if they can efficiently, strategically, ethically integrate generative AI into their organization. As Gen AI evolves, so too does the competitive landscape of the models and tools that are available to access its benefits. Luckily, early economic insights can help both business leaders and policymakers understand the opportunities and risks posed by the stratospheric growth of Gen AI. I'm here with my co-host, Lexi Michaud. Hi, Lexi.
Hi, Jacqueline. Thanks so much.
Can you introduce today's economists who are going to walk us through these insights, please?
Yes, happy to. So today we have two economists with us. We have Andrea Zoni and we have Matteo Foschi. So Andrea Zoni is a vice president in Charles River Associates, Washington, D.C. office. He has worked as an antitrust economist on global mergers and merger litigations across various industries. But particularly relevant for today, he's worked on the tech industry, the data stack, and AI. We have Matteo Foschi, who's also a vice president in Charles River Associates, London office, and he has extensive experience as an antitrust economist in global merger control, as well as antitrust matters in the digital space, including AI. Together, Andrea and Matteo have recently written a paper with two other co-authors, Chiara Farinato and Oliver Latham. And the paper is called Contested Ground, Early Competition and Market Dynamics in Generative AI. So very relevant to today's topic. Welcome to the show, Andrea and Matteo.
Thank you.
Nice to be here.
So to get started, what interests you both as economists about the advent of AI and what economic issues do you find worthy of study?
So I can take that one. I think at the beginning, you know, there was a lot of attention from regulators, really. And in a sense, it was them to spark the attention for everyone else. The Federal Trade Commission, the UK CMA, European Commission, all of them started issuing reports, opinions, papers that looked at the AI space and tried to understand whether a competition problem may arise. And it may arise from first mover advantages, from partnership between companies at different layers of the supply chain or the stack, as you call it in tech. And what is and what was interesting to us is that this is probably the first time in tech in particular that a new product and a new fundamental technology is introduced during a mature regulatory environment. And within that environment, there is a clear attention from the community to make sure that we don't replicate some of the mistakes that we made or that probably were made in the past and miss out on the consolidation that happened, for example, in the Web 2.0 markets, which I think Andrea will define a bit better later on. And so we got interested into how all of this functions. What markets is AI bringing along? What economic features are they characterized by? And what do these mean for the stability in the future? And to do that, we effectively done three things, I would say. The first one is, again, there is a clear recognition there are some economic fundamentals that have undergone in the past 20 years that have led to some sort of concentration in digital space. And so the question is, you know, are these fundamentals replicating in the AI space, or are there others maybe that are emerging, or maybe there aren't any that are actually suggesting that concentration and tipping could be a problem? The second point was to study the supply side and whether there is vertical integration dynamics in this space. And, you know, alongside new technologies, what AI is actually bringing is all of these new partnerships, new ways in which companies are cooperating, organic growth. And so all of that will have an impact on the consumers and on competition landscape. And we want to understand that dynamic and that impact. And then as a third and last piece is the demand side. Because obviously it's one thing to think, you know, suppliers are going to do something and behave in a certain way that it's going to shape how the markets are formed. But it's another one to know how consumers will react to that, how they will adopt solutions, and whether that behavior will affect contestability and competition in the long term.
Thanks, Matteo. And I think to your first point, it's a little bit of looking at the analogs that we have in the past with Web 2.0 and understanding what that might mean for Gen AI. So why is what occurred with Web 2.0 of interest to economists and an era that regulators look at when evaluating what potential economic concerns there might be related to Gen AI?
Hi. Yes, I'll take that one. So first of all, I guess just a little bit of lingo for those that don't necessarily always work in the tech space. So what's Web 2.0? Web 2.0 essentially refers to the second generation of the World Wide Web, which was characterized by a shift from, you know, static read-only websites to interactive and sort of user-driven platforms. So, you know, think about social media. Think about commenting, think about user-generated content, you know, blogs, social media, Wikipedia, social networking, online community. So that's kind of is what is generally characterized as Web 2.0. And we know that from experience and from kind of looking at history that, you know, this era of internet was sort of characterized by large platform-based ecosystem. You know, think about Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. The reason why the Web 2.0 experience is useful is because one thing that economists and regulators observe is that there are powerful forces, powerful economic forces that kind of led towards tipping or market dominance of some of this industry, of some of these segments, you know, within the internet by a few players. And over time, you know, the regulators and economists have pointed out to a lot of these economic factors. And I think here we can discuss sort of three of those that come more often at the attention, which are network effects, both sort of direct and indirect network effects. So network effects just means that the more people use a product, the better the product becomes. Whether I like more of my friends to be on Facebook and that sort of increases the value of Facebook for me, or whether advertisers like a lot of people to be on Facebook so that they can kind of reach a broader audience. Those are all examples of network effects and how the number of people that use a product actually increases the value of the product. The other important factors that we have pointed out is sort of data feedback loops. And what does that mean is that the more people use a product, the more data is generated, the better the product becomes because of the data that is generated. And this can create some kind of a self-fulfilling mechanism where products with more users just get better. And then the other factors that I think is important and relevant in this case is zero pricing. Zero pricing is relevant because we are all familiar with Facebook and Instagram and Google. We don't need to pay anything to use them. They're just available to us. The reason why this is relevant is because in a way it mutes away one of the important factors that where competition happens, which is pricing. And so when you put all of these factors together, the network effects, the data feedback loop, and zero pricing, these all together create what economists and regulators have called this flywheel effect, where essentially you get these self-reinforcing mechanisms where, you know, you have more users, you get a better product, you get more users because you have a better product, and so on and so forth. It creates kind of this cycle of constant improvement of a product, where pricing doesn't seem to pay a role anymore, where essentially a new entrant, a newcomer, cannot use price to compete with an existing providers. And so regulators are keenly aware of this dynamic that seem to have driven some of the Web 2.0, and they would like to observe Gen AI to make sure that maybe these dynamics don't replicate themselves.
Got it.
And Andrea, I'd love to ask a follow-up question, Jacqueline, if that's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Andrea, just to confirm, when you talk about the factors that you just described, are those the same factors that we're talking about when we say, you know, that Web 2.0 players had first mover advantages or early advantages at the start?
Yes, that's exactly the point. Is if you get scale or if you get some early advantage, then that early advantage can essentially compound over time because of these factors that I just mentioned.
And it's fairly early, right? But what does your research show about how Web 2.0 compares with what we are seeing so far with Gen AI? And based on what you found so far, what might that mean for potential impacts of Gen AI on competition?
Yes, so that's a good question. So that's kind of one of the questions that we addressed in the article that Matteo and I and Chiara and Ollie wrote. And our conclusion, you know, the short answer is that, you know, Gen AI, at least at this stage, looks very different from Web 2.0. And the reason is that these three factors that I just mentioned, you know, the network effects, the data feedback loops, and the zero pricing don't really seem to apply. So for example, you know, network effects. How valuable is ChatGPT to me? It doesn't really depend on how many people use ChatGPT. And because a lot of these tools are really single-sided, they don't bring together multiple users like some of the Web 2.0 platforms did, there is not a lot of scope for these kind of indirect and direct network effects that, you know, help some of the Web 2.0 platforms. Similarly, you know, data feedback loops, which were very important during the Web 2.0, don't seem to have the same strength for Gen AI. It is true that, you know, these LLMs model, these Gen AI models are trained on data. And so having more data is, of course, helpful. But there isn't the same immediate feedback or immediate relationship between having more data and immediately improving your products. Doesn't happen as fast as it would happen, for example, for Google, for search, because these models, you know, need to be retrained. And in fact, there is actually a risk that having an LLM or a Gen AI model retrained on synthetic data, sort of meaning on data generated by Gen AI, actually will lead to model collapse, which essentially means more hallucinations, amplifying biases and errors. So that's another reason why data feedback don't seem to be as strong for Gen AI. And the last and very important piece is that Gen AI tools are not zero priced. In fact, Gen AI tools are extremely expensive to run. Every time we ask a question to ChatGPT, in the background, there is a big model that needs to run and to make inference. And that is very expensive. It's very expensive in terms of compute. So because the marginal cost is not zero, sorry for throwing an economic term there, but the marginal cost, you know, for adding one more user to Facebook or doing one more search on Google, it's kind of very low, almost zero essentially, but it's not zero for Gen AI models. So that leaves a lot of room for pricing. And in fact, pricing in Gen AI, at least at this stage, seems to be playing more of kind of a traditional role where you have, you know, tier pricing, and if you pay more, you get a better product. So these are the reasons why we don't see this Web 2.0 dynamics. What it means for competition is, it's still early to make a conclusion, but so far we have seen a lot of entry in the foundational model, and, you know, the CMA that Matteo mentioned earlier, you know, documented in one of his report, like a lot of entry in the foundational model. At the same time, we see billions of dollars being poured into this. So it right now it's a very dynamic. We don't see this evidence of tipping. We don't see these forces at work, and it's kind of confirmed by how dynamic the industry is.
Andrea, I'm glad you brought that up because I actually saw a headline this morning about Sam Altman issuing an internal letter at OpenAI and essentially calling for code red and saying, you know, we're doubling down, we're going to focus specifically on ChatGPT, on improving it because of how much competition they're facing. And they're actually going to shift resources and time away from some other products to specifically focus on improving ChatGPT. So just to bring that into some of the findings that you and your co-authors talk about in the paper, if AI is developing as fast as it is and LLMs are developing as fast as they are, and the market is as dynamic as even what, you know, Sam Altman and OpenAI seem to be suggesting, is there an issue here? Is there, based on your findings and what you've described, can we conclude there's never going to be an issue like there was in Web 2.0?
So maybe I can interject here, because I mean, it's no surprise that the answer is no. We don't think that's the case. We don't think that our research is going to show that there's never going to be an issue. I mean, Jacqueline, before I even said, you know, it's very early to call it, and it is indeed very early. I think the question is, how will the market develop? So, and a few points come to mind. You know, the first one is that we cannot really predict whether some of the dynamics that Andrea was discussing before, zero prices or the feedback loops, will never come up in some of the applications. The reality is that maybe there are some narrow aspects, some narrow use cases where data feedbacks will actually be important and you will be able to gain some level of scale effects from them. The second aspect is also, and still actually on sort of the Web 2.0 features, is we don't know how the cost of running these models will evolve. What's happening at the moment is that for a new chip that comes to market, there is a more powerful model that comes to market. And so the distance between how much you need to perform and how much it costs to do it is kind of constant. But what happens once we take AGI, so use artificial general intelligence, which is supposed to be as smart as a human being, what happens then? Does that mean that the model need to plateau and so the chips can actually catch up and the marginal cost of running the model starts decreasing? We don't really know that, and that's only time will tell. The second aspect is also that, you know, we know that AI will change our lives, but we haven't really seen it quite yet, right? I mean, probably all of us use one of the chatbots between, you know, Claude, Gemini, Copilot and whatnot, but it hasn't really fundamentally changed the way in which we go about our lives. And it hasn't really delivered the game changers for mass consumptions. And until that comes up, it's a bit difficult to really understand how competition will play out. And then the third point, which is, you know, goes back to what we were saying before, nobody seems to really be making much money on this. I mean, obviously, you know, probably besides NVIDIA, but a lot of the companies are losing a lot of money. OpenAI is set to lose further billions this year. Anthropic is set to reportedly break even only by 2028. And then you have all of the billions that Google, Meta, Amazon, Microsoft, and the others are pouring in. It's still a question mark on whether we will see the return on investment that these companies are expecting. So once you put all of these in the cauldron, then you don't really know what portion you're going to get. So we can tell you how it looks today, but I think it's important that we all continue to monitor what's going to happen in the future.
Matteo, just to go back to network effects, I think at least anecdotally, a lot of people talk about the fact that the more you use, say, ChatGPT or Claude, the more it learns off of your specific data and the better the program actually gets for you. Is that likely? I mean, to me, that seems like a sort of network effect in itself. Is that likely to increase in time in terms of importance for these programs?
It's an open question. It's a very good point, and it's an open question, right? The reality is, it's not that there are no data feedback loops. Surely you can learn something from how people interact with their models, especially if they're asking repeated questions or if there are repeated interactions within a certain specific context. But it's just not remotely the same as it was, for example, in search. Search is essentially an econometrician, you know, dream situation. You put a keyword, you get four links, and then the user need to click on the four links. It's, you know, you can model that and understand exactly how the selection of those four links has performed. You can't really quite do that with, say, ChatGPT, right? You can ask it to, you know, write a slide or write a speech, and then the user is just going to use it and consume it. And there isn't really a feedback there. The fact that they're coming back maybe is a feedback. The fact that they ask for certain improvements is a feedback, but it isn't quite of the same nature and immediate applicability that it is in search or other applications. Not yet, at least.
Yeah, and just to add, like what Matteo alluded earlier is that there may be narrow application in which network effects or data feedback loop are going to be more prevalent or more important. So that's also something that, you know, people need to take into account when they're thinking about generative AI.
So turning to another dynamic that has been a focus of regulators, including the FTC, the CMA, the European Commission, and also came up in your paper, is how we should be thinking about vertical integration along the AI stack. We have companies, you know, NVIDIA, Google, Meta, as you talk about in your paper, that are making dozens of acquisitions up and down the AI stack. So how should we be thinking about that? And what conclusions can we draw about what that means for competition?
Yes, again, for table setting. So what is the AI stack? The AI stack is simply just the value chain, right? That goes from chip manufacturers to chip designers to compute, so that, you know, the people that provide these large cloud server farms that you need to run these LLMs. Then you have the people who write the LLMs, you know, the foundational models, and then you have, you know, the applications, the chatbot or whatever other AI-based application that consumers actually use. So we looked at integration within the value chain, within the AI value chain. And I think our article reports a lot of interesting findings, but I want to discuss only two of them, and I think are relevant at this point. So the first one is that from a vertical deal partnership and vertical integration perspective, we observe a lot of activity. We observe a lot of activities, a lot of companies that are moving from the layers in which they are to sort of invest, partner, buy companies that are in other layers. And this is true, and I think this is one of the interesting findings. This is true not only for the so-called big tech company, you know, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, Meta, Apple, and Nvidia. It's true for them. They're moving down and up and down sort of the value chain. But it's true for smaller companies as well, which we think it's an interesting finding. It's sort of a little bit contra. People would be worried about these large tech companies buying up all the AI stack. So that's one of the interesting findings. The other interesting finding that I think you can see it in the news is that rather than going towards, like, let me call them quote unquote closed ecosystem, where essentially you have vertical integration and partnership that essentially foreclose or you know, keep some of these companies and this model kind of within a closed ecosystem. I think we're actually observing what we call like strategic edging in the paper, where essentially you have companies partnering with multiple partners at the same level. So very recent news that people might have seen is a big partnership between Microsoft, NVIDIA, and Anthropic. So NVIDIA is chip designer, Microsoft compute, as well as other activities within the AI stack. And then you have Anthropic, which is one of the large LLMs, one of the foundational models, where essentially, you know, you have Anthropic that's going to be running on Microsoft Azure, powered by the NVIDIA chips. So why is that relevant? That's relevant because at the same time, Microsoft has a similar partnership with OpenAI, which is another LLM. And similarly, Anthropic has similar partnership with the other big cloud provider, Microsoft, as well as Google, as well as Amazon. And so that's kind of what we mean when we say that what we really observe is sort of this strategic edging where people partner at multiple levels. So why is all of this relevant and kind of what it means for competition? I mean, I think to understand the impact of this activity, we should just go back to our sort of standard tool of economics that they teach us that when we're looking at vertical transactions and vertical deals and partnership, you know, there are at least two possible sort of countervailing dynamic. On the one hand, you might be concerned that vertical transactions mean foreclosure of important inputs or important customers across the value chain. But then on the other hand, you know, vertical integrations and partnership can really generate a lot of efficiencies. They can reduce cost, internalize spillovers, accelerate innovation, for example. And, you know, all of these factors need to be taken into account when we observe. And, you know, the two empirical observations that I discussed, they point a little bit to sort of what is happening and, you know, whether what we are observing is really because of internalization of spillover, strategic edging, and efficiency as opposed to kind of trying to create a kind of a closed system where, you know, you only have access to certain sort of data inputs or certain customers. So I think overall, the conclusion in our paper is that, you know, the aggregate picture, we don't see any sort of alarming trends, but as all antitrust practitioners know, I mean, every deal needs to be assessed on its merits because it may be different from industry to industry, from company to company, from deal to deal, how it's structured and what the effect it's going to have on consumers. And because, like Matteo was saying, there is a lot that we still don't know. And, you know, the industry is evolving rapidly. And, you know, depending in which direction it evolves, you know, we're going to have to look at the different deals differently.
Thank you. When we first started, you mentioned that there were three dynamics of the market that you were taking a look at to make assessments at this stage of what competition looks like. And I believe the third one you mentioned was that early patterns of adoption can give us an indication of what's going on in this market. So what are you seeing so far and what do these early demand patterns tell us about competitive conditions?
Yeah, that's right. It's definitely sort of demand patterns and adoption patterns. And so the idea here was, you know, there are other very well-established economic fundamentals that show the opposite direction of concentration and market tipping. And one of these is multi-homing. multi-homing from consumers is actually usually depleting the risk of concentration and competition risks. And the idea is, on the one side, you know, if my consumers are multi-homing, it means that every dollar is contestable. If all of my consumers use another solution together with mine, it means that every time they have to decide where to put their dollars, they have a choice between doing it on my solutions or someone else's. And so I'm fighting for every bit of my revenue. At the same time, it means that if there is a new entrant who wants to come in, they don't necessarily have to convince people to move away from incumbents. They can just convince them to multi-home, just so that they can adopt their solution, scale, and effectively, you know, transform themselves into an incumbent themselves, which is what you would want in a healthy competitive market. And so what we set off to study was, you know, how are consumers actually adopting these solutions? Are they multi-homing? Are they multi-adopting? Or are they focusing their usage on a single one? And we were lucky enough that one of our co-authors, Chiara, who is at Harvard, could access the database they have there of respondents. So there were multiple organizations that could respond to our survey, including people in, you know, C-suite, presidents, and chief executives of companies. And so we ran a survey among those people to understand how they demand AI and how they use it in their work environment. And, you know, the results were pretty striking. I mean, the first one is obviously pretty much everyone uses AI, not in the same sort of transformational way than we were saying before, but still they use it in everyday life. Around 90% of respondents say they use it. And of these, around 80% multi-home. Means that 80% of the people who are actually using some form of AI today do it across different models and across different chatbots. And, you know, the interesting part there is also that the probability of multi-homing across more than four models is actually higher than those that multi-home across only two models. So if you do use more than one, you're going to use a lot of them. And the third interesting point was, you know, we did expect that people in tech, in finance, or in legal profession and economists would actually use these type of tools. But we were striken by the fact that even education, manufacturing, you know, 60, 70% of the people who responded were indeed multi-homing and were indeed using AI. And so our read of that data is that essentially consumer behavior suggests that there is a growing user awareness of lock-in risks. And, you know, the volatility of this Gen AI tools has been internalized by users. They're actively managing that risk and they're diversifying their dependencies so that if an ecosystem were to try and lock them in, they actually have alternatives they can rely on and they are not stuck with one solution who might then gain the market power.
That's super interesting and really enlightening that you were able to access that data and do that survey and understand how it's really being used in the context of your other findings. So thank you very much for sharing what we've learned so far. And it gives everybody, I think, things to keep an eye on and watch out for to see what happens as this dynamic market develops. But before we let you go, we want to learn some things about you both. So a question we always start with, just to break the ice, is what's something about yourselves that we might not know if we only worked with you?
This is my fun fact for the cocktail party that creates a lot of controversy sometimes is you can't really tell if you look at me, but I played 1 year of professional basketball. That means some very different things in Italy and the US. So I'm going to leave it at that. And, you know, if people want more detail, they, you know, see me at the next cocktail party and I can explain.
Okay. It's a good reason for people to reach out to you after this episode.
I didn't know that. And, you know, we wrote a paper together. And I didn't know that. I learned it today.
Matteo, what about you?
I used to be a dance teacher when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. In fact, this is how I met my wife and paid for some of my studies. Unfortunately, I don't dance anymore unless I am at parties, which after fatherhood is basically never. But if I get the chance, I might.
But I can see it in the posture. I'm sure it helps with all our long hours at desks.
Yeah, indeed.
And now it's time for the Curious Hat.
So my question for you both is, staying on the theme of tech, what is one guilty pleasure app or game or show that you each have? And when do you find yourself turning to it in your day-to-day?
Well, I own every single video game console that ever existed in the history of humanity. That's not entirely right. Maybe I don't have the early ones, but I own quite a lot of them.
My husband and I were just talking about Sega Genesis because my sons recently watched Sonic for the first time. Is that in your collection?
I've never been much of a fan of the Sega games, but it's definitely there.
I was wondering what happened to it. It's been a long time since I thought about Sega.
Yeah, I think they kind of disappeared a bit from the mainstream for a few years, but then I think they're coming back quite strong.
Yeah, they used to be a console and now they're mostly a game developer, right?
Andrea, well, what about you?
Well, my guilty pleasure is very similar. I don't own a lot of consoles, but when I find myself a little bit of time and I want to relax, I do play some mobile gaming. So I have a similar. You know.
Do you have any preferred games? You know, Candy Crush, something else?
Farmville.
I play a lot of war strategy games. It's a very boring answer, but I play a lot of kind of war strategy games that kind of think risk, but online and a little bit more complicated than that.
Well, I have a gamer husband and a 7-year-old who won't stop thinking about Minecraft. So maybe he has econometrics in his future.
Well, but in the future, econometrics will be done by AI. So
yeah. We'll have to think of something else. Dancing. AI will never take over dancing or basketball. Yeah. Well, thank you both so much. Super enlightening. We'll link your article with this episode so our listeners can take a look at it and learn more. And it was really great having you on our Curious Amalgam. And see you next time.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Our Curious Amalgam, a competition, consumer protection, data protection, and privacy law podcast. It is produced and shared around the globe by ABA's Antitrust Law Section. The opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily represent their employer or other organizations. If you like what you heard or would like to become a member of the American Bar Association, please check out what the Antitrust Section has to offer at ambar.org, antitrust. You can learn more about our podcast at ourcuriousamalgam.com. If you have comments, suggestions, or podcast ideas, please reach out to us at podcast@ourcuriousamalgam.com. Until next time, thank you for listening.